Good morning. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for host Charity Nebbe. Today with me, our guests, Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist. Hi, Donald and Richard.
Good morning, Emily.
Good morning.
So earlier this week, the National Weather Service picked up radar of what looked like moderate rainfall, but closer surveillance determined it was actually a swarm of mayflies. And it's pretty crazy. There's some great pictures from Wisconsin. I encourage you to look on our Facebook page where we posted a link to the radar surveillance as well as some photos, like I said, from Wisconsin where there's just an abundance of the insect. It honestly looks like you couldn't even breathe without breathing in a mayfly. Donald, what caused this sudden burst of mayfly? Have you seen some of these photos?
Yes. Went online and looked at those. And this happens periodically. And people who live along the Mississippi River, pretty much the full length of the Mississippi River, and even on other major rivers, know what we're talking about when just after dark, these winged insects, they vary in length from about 1/2 inch to 1 1/4 inch in length. They have these clear cellophane wings, and then they have these long bristles on their tails. They emerge out of the water by the tens of thousands, and in some cases, tens of millions. And they are there overnight, and they are attracted to lights, which just makes them a terrible nuisance because they swarm around the street lights, they swarm around your porch lights, they swarm around the windows of the shops that face the river and so forth. So these huge mass emergences are well known for the full length of the Mississippi River. And I guess the answer to the question why is, well, that's what they do. Their survival technique is to emerge in huge numbers all at once. And when you do that, enough will survive whatever predators, whatever pitfalls are out there. Enough will survive to perpetuate the species. And then someday in the future, it will happen again. So mayflies are well known for this behavior. The name of the insect, I think, is very well stated. The name for this group of insects is Ephemeroptera. And ephemera, just like the word ephemeral, describes their adult life duration. They only live overnight. So they come out in these huge swarms. They may come out several nights in a row, but each individual only lived for about 12 hours. And when the sun comes up, those millions that you saw swarming around the streetlights are now dead on the pavement. And that's another nuisance to take care of.
You know, it sounds a lot like the life cycle of a cicada. You know, they have this kind of dormant phase where, well, in the mayfly's case, they're, you know, in the river, in the mud. And then, you know, they all come up at once as kind of a defense mechanism.
There is a similarity, but without the specific periodicity that mayflies are a little more haphazard. It's not this nice, distinct, all of them at one time. We can have mayflies every year. And in fact, we do in most areas. We have mayflies every year. So it's not like we're waiting for the next emergence when they're all going to come out. But these emergences are well known and well documented, and Lake Erie and other areas have them as well. So it's not carefully timed or specifically timed the way the cicadas are. But yes, the mayflies spend about 2 to 3 years as a nymph in the mud at the bottom of the river. And there they're feeding on small fish and other debris and so forth, and small insects. And when the time is right and the conditions are right, they all emerge. And here they come up out of the water as the adult stage with wings in order to mate, lay eggs, reproduce, and die by sunup.
This very unique lifestyle that they have. And I think, you know, these insects have been around for millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, actually. Does having this interesting life cycle, does that help or hurt adaptation?
Interesting question. And I've paused because in all the years I've been talking about mayflies on the Mississippi River, no one's ever asked me about the adaptation of it.
Well, have they changed very much over the years?
Oh, I assume they have. But the thing about mayflies even though there are these swarms that may all be the same species, one of our researchers here at Iowa State University way back in the 1990s surveyed the mayflies of Iowa and found that in the state we have 68 different kinds, 68 different species of mayflies. So there's lots of variation in exactly how they look. They all have the same pattern of living in the river or living in a stream and then emerging in mass numbers. But it works for them. Mayflies are good fish food. They are an important part of the river ecosystem because they are a link in the food chain. And they are eating smaller critters, and then in turn, trout and other fish are eating them. So they are an important link in the food chain, and these mass emergences probably help. That's the adaptation part. The mass emergences help them, a few of them escape the predation and live to reproduce.
Mm. What can mayflies tell us?
Oh, this is an exciting story because when it happens, when these mass emergences happen, people immediately think, oh, this is terrible. This is something that we really have to get on and do something about. Mayflies don't bite. They don't even eat. In their 12-hour adult stage, they're not even going to eat anything. They can't sting. They don't feed on our crops. They don't feed on us or our pets. They don't feed on our buildings. But it's a nuisance. It's an annoyance to have these millions all at once at your porch light or at the front of your store. And people think we ought to do something about it. But just as quickly as someone complains about mayflies, I try to remind them this is a good thing because mayflies are an indication that the river is healthy. And an example of that goes back to the 1970s in Lake Erie around Cleveland and Toledo, Ohio. The lake and the rivers got so polluted that the mayflies disappeared. Mayflies are a bioindicator. That is, when things go wrong with the river ecosystem, such as pollution or excess organic matter or other problems, when things go wrong, the mayflies are one of the sensitive critters that just dies off. Hmm. So these mass emergences of mayflies I take as good news because it means the river is healthy. And if the river weren't healthy, we wouldn't be seeing these, and then we would have other problems. But certainly people who live along the river know that they have to regulate their lighting at night. The highway department will shut off the street lights over the on the bridges and so forth to avoid this accumulation of millions of dead, slimy mayflies on the pavement that sometimes they have to get out the snow plows to push them off the road. So lighting management is what we do about it. There is no treatment. We're not going to go out and spray them with a helicopter. We're not going to poison the river to try to get rid of them. This is just something we have to grin and bear it and enjoy it while we've got them.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're certainly, like you said, a good indicator that our rivers are healthy, but are they an important part of the ecosystem? I mean, do a lot of animals and bugs come out to eat the mayfly?
Mostly, I think it's birds and probably bats will try to eat them at night during these mass emergences. Coming out at night helps them escape a little bit of the predation, but certainly as they are emerging from the water and as they are laying their eggs back on the water surface, the fish that are surface feeders are going to come up and feed on them. And of course, mayflies are models for fly fishermen who tie their own flies, and they'll try to mimic exactly what the mayfly looks like when they make a fly with a hook in it so that when they go fishing for trout, they can duplicate that and use the artificial fly to catch fish. So, yes, they're an important part of the ecosystem. They're an interesting story to tell, and it's not every year we get these big emergences. And so you start asking, well, why this year? I don't know. But if we backtrack on the life cycle, we realize that these mayflies that are emerging this year were eggs 2 to 3 years ago. So we can't look at just what's happened this year. We have to go back and try to remember what happened 2 to 3 years ago that produced such an abundance this year. We don't get these big emergences every year, but it really spectacular when it happens. I know 4th of July celebrations are frequently canceled along the river because they'll have a mayfly emergence. When there was a racetrack along the river in Dubuque, they would cancel races occasionally because of these mass emergences and because they would be so thick at the lights.
Hmm. Well, much to my dismay, I actually live near the Iowa River in Iowa City, and I've noticed that the buffalo gnats have come back after, you know, we experienced so much flooding. You know, the park was all flooded by my house, and, you know, now the mosquitoes are here more than ever. So, you know, are these the types of bugs loving the wet summer that we've experienced so far? Are there other ones that we're seeing that we don't normally see in such numbers?
The buffalo gnat or the biting gnat, the black fly problem, seems to be mostly eastern Iowa. We're not really getting that problem here in the center of the state like the eastern part of the state is. That's another insect that lives in rivers, and when we get good water, and it has to be flowing rivers, not stagnant, standing water, they just seem to have done very well with whatever water conditions have happened over the last couple, 3 years, so their populations have built up. What's hard to explain and what I can't really quite grasp is how does flooding and how do high water volumes followed by droughts affect these insects? It seems like we've had low river flows followed by floods and these huge torrents of water moving by, but yet the mayflies are still in the Mississippi River in spite of the amount of water that has passed by them, and the buffalo gnats are still in the Iowa River and Cedar River and the the other river over there. Go ahead, help me out. What is the other one?
Maquoketa,
the Maquoketa River. They're still there in spite of the changes in water levels. And that seems like a little hard to explain other than insects are very adaptable. They're very tenacious. They're very persistent, and they're going to do quite well. Now, mosquitoes really don't have much to do with rivers. We see flooding along the rivers, but as long as the flood is up and the water is moving, we're not raising mosquitoes. It's when the water levels recede and we have these impoundments of water that doesn't move.
Swamps
and depressions and impoundments, that's where the mosquitoes will be reproducing. And for the frequent rains that we've had this summer, this spring throughout the year, we have plenty of mosquitoes out there to feed on us right now.
Well, we're talking insects today on Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me today, our guests, Donald Lewis of Iowa State University Extension Entomologist and Richard Duran of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. You can join our conversation as well for your questions about plants, your garden, insects you've seen around your house. The number to call is 866-780-9100, or you can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a moment. Happy Friday. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for host Charity Nebbe. With me today, our guests, Donald Lewis of Iowa State University Extension Entomologist and Richard Duran, horticulturist at Iowa State University Extension. And today we're talking about mayflies, about cicadas, mosquitoes. And I want to start off this segment with a question from Carol. She says that the annual cicadas where I live in Cedar Rapids are just now starting to sing in the evenings. Mm-hmm. According to the phenology journal that I keep, this seems to be about 2 weeks later than in past years. Could this be to cooler weather this year, or is it a coincidence of my inconsistent journal keeping? We were just talking about the mayflies, and they just now came out around northeast Iowa, but they're called the mayfly. They usually come around in May. Is this something that we're seeing across all types of insects, that they're emerging a little bit later than usual?
I think it's highly variable, for one thing, and it may vary with the area. Mayflies are interesting. We call them mayflies, even though they emerge in April, May, June, July, August, and September. It's like we call those large beetles June bugs, even though we may find them in May, June, July, or August. So the common names we give may have fit one species at one place at one time, and we use those common names for a large number of species, and it doesn't always fit. Now, back to the phenology of are things late? Many things were. The Japanese beetle is one that we normally see by the end of June. Sometimes the third week of June we'll see Japanese beetles, and this year it was on into early July before we saw them. When I walk the dog at night here in the north part of Ames, I used to see, in years past, I would see fireflies sometimes in May. You would just see one or two across the lawn, or you'd see them out on the golf course. This year, it was more like June, toward the end of June, before I saw any mayflies, and I'm still not seeing very many. So there may be a connection here between weather events, severe winter. I think the double whammy of last year's drought, followed by a deep freeze of the soil in the winter, may have limited some of these populations of some insects, but obviously they didn't limit the populations of black flies or mayflies. So it's all variable, but I agree with the general observation that things seem to be coming on later than this usual this year. And, of course, we could verify that by asking Richard if everything bloomed 2 weeks later than usual this year.
I would say things are maybe a week or 10 days behind normal. And I'm not sure what normal is in Iowa as far as weather. But I would say about a week or 10 days behind normal.
But that journal keeping, that's just such a great record to have in terms of when these things came out and when did you hear the first cicada? When did you hear the first katydid? Cicadas usually sing in the evening. The ones that come out then after dark and sing high in the trees are the katydids. It's more of a clack kind of a sound, zat, zat, zat sound. I've heard my first one now just this past week, and they'll be with us till frost. But these observations of when you hear the first one, they're always kind of exciting, and when you see your first flyer, first firefly. But then you also have to record, when did you see your last one? And those are interesting observations to make, and it means you're paying pretty close attention to what's going on if you're making those records.
And we have this observation from Bob, who says, I have a 7-acre pond, and it's had a massive mayfly hatch each year, but for 3 years it's stopped cold. Why did this happen?
Well, we have to think about water quality. We have to think about water levels. We've had drought in that time, and if that decreased the pond level, it may have been to the detriment of that particular species of mayfly. And it's, remember, there are 68 different species, so we could talk about 68 different combinations of factors that are likely to have an effect. But certainly drought would be one, maybe excess sedimentation, maybe change in nutrient loads, maybe change in what the mayflies eat. Maybe it isn't, maybe the mayflies aren't the first thing that changed, but maybe there's something else in the food chain further down the line that changed that the mayflies are responding to. So too many variables to know exactly, but yes, things do change from year to year. Mayflies could be up in some areas. They're down in his pond. On the other hand, Japanese beetles that have been up so badly for so many people for so many years this year are way down. So it's always exciting to see what's going to come next.
I'd like to get to the phones. We have a couple people on the line, and you can give us a call. We have a few lines open, 866-780-9100. If you have a question about your plants, insects you've noticed, again, that number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, and you can also post to our Facebook page where we've posted some pictures of the mayfly surgeons in northeast Iowa. Here's Jerry from Waverly. He has a question about insects for you, Donald. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, I. You may have answered part of my question about the Japanese beetles. I saw just two of them this year on a linden tree, and none any since then. And are we out of them? Or are we going to have a huge influx next summer?
My prediction is what you see is what you're going to get. The research that was done in northern Illinois over winter found that two-thirds of the Japanese beetle grub, that's the immature larva that lives down in the soil, two-thirds of them died last year from the double whammy of too dry last summer, too cold for too long over the winter. So I think the Japanese beetles that we have seen are all that we're going to get. Now, eventually, they will build back up. That each Japanese beetle female can lay a few hundred eggs, and if half of those survive, then we have a few hundred grubs, and it'll may take a couple of years, but we will get back to levels that we will notice. But in the meantime, isn't it great to be able to count the Japanese beetles on one hand instead of counting them by the bucketful?
That is correct, because these linden trees were just stripped, you know, in years past.
Two things are happening here, Jerry, and one is over time, Japanese beetle populations that are new to an area explode. But in a little longer period of time, they will start to decline. Now, we saw that last year here on the street in front of the Iowa Public Radio station where I'm sitting, that there's a row of linden trees. And they had turned brown every year from about 2008 to 2012. And in 2013, there were a lot fewer Japanese beetles on this street. And that's the typical explosion followed by a slight reduction. But this year, that slight reduction has been hit with the double whammy of weather as well. So stay tuned, and we'll try to be back next year to tell you whether they rebounded or whether they're going to stay down for a while.
Thanks for your call, Jerry. Up next is Amy in Des Moines. Good morning, Amy.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a two-part question on sod and lawns in general. We just had sod put in a week ago, and I've been watering it every day with a system of sprinklers and hoses that I set up. We don't intend to water the lawn once it's established. So my first question is, what's the best timing and amount of water to use now to encourage deep roots and strong grass?
Right. What you want to do now is you've watered once a day for a week. At this point, you want to gradually water less frequently. So what I would suggest is maybe skipping a day.
Okay.
And then water. Then maybe skipping 2 days. And then water. And hopefully within maybe 2 or 3 weeks, once a week is all you're going to do. Just once a week.
2 or 3 weeks, once a week.
Right.
Okay.
And when you do it once a week, try to put on basically 1 inch of water when you do it. Okay. Because really the sod only needs about 1 inch of water per week. So if you do water once a week, do it and put on 1 inch. And once we get into September, if we're getting good rainfall, you can probably stop.
Awesome. Sounds great. My second part of that question is we don't intend to use chemical fertilizers or herbicides either. And so I was wanting to know, can a newly established lawn do without them, or should we at least try to use an environmentally friendly version?
What I would say is if you have good quality sod, it should be nice and thick. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And that provides very few opportunities for weeds. Weeds basically thrive if you have opportunities, if you, let's say, have a poorly managed lawn. So the key there is to keep the lawn well mowed. Not short, but well mowed. I would be cutting around 3 inches right now as far as height. And you want to mow the grass when it reaches a height of 4 to 4.5 inches. Once we get into September, I would lower that to around 2.5 inches. And mow it when it gets around 3, 3.5 inches. And that way you'll encourage the grass to be nice and thick. And if you have a nice thick lawn, you're going to have far fewer weeds in the yard.
Thanks for your call, Amy. We have a few people wanting to talk more about Japanese beetles. First up is Greg in Shell Rock. Hi, Greg.
Good morning.
Good morning. So
I just had an observation. Yeah, I had a degree in Iowa State many, many years ago in botany when Dr. Isley and Dr. Canapas were around. Anyway, the last few years in the acreage I own, I've been raising a small section of red raspberries and battling the Japanese beetles, not with chemicals. I did it by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And for years I did that, and I tried to figure out what can I do. And finally it dawned on me that if you prune your raspberries back to about 30 inches in the spring, is usually when I do it, before they start leafing out, you will be able to harvest raspberries about 2 weeks before the Japanese beetles show up. And so I do half my raspberries 30 inches, the other half to the ground. And the half to the ground start producing in August, and there won't be many because the Japanese beetles are too thick. So that's what I figured out. That's the best way to battle them, is just, you know, cut them 30 inches and harvest early.
Yeah, it's great when you can time crops that way. Another example of that is people who can wait and plant their muskmelons later usually have fewer striped cucumber beetles. So this is a great observation. Which kind of do you know what variety of raspberry it is that you can treat that way?
You know, I don't. It's just a raspberry that my mom had and her mom before her, and I just kept moving it along with me. So I left
right.
it in several places.
Probably some fall-bearing variety, maybe Heritage or something of that nature.
Oh, I'm sorry. There's I cut really you off there, Greg.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Oh. All right. Thanks, Greg. We have another beetle question comment from Matt and Floyd and some tomato plants. How's it going, Matt?
Good.
So what's going on with your tomato plants?
Well, we noticed in our potato plants what we believe to be marginated blister beetles.
Sure.
A couple weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And they were defoliating our red Norlands pretty hard.
Uh-huh.
And we had treated those with some diatomaceous earth, and it looked like it took care of them. We also have them in our tomato plants, and some of the stuff that I read online was discouraging us from using the diatomaceous earth where we want pollinators. So I was wondering if there was another way to take care of those
Yeah.
before they defoliate our tomatoes.
Well, I'm glad the diatomaceous earth worked for you, because outdoors we don't see a lot of success with diatomaceous earth, because it has to stay dry, it has to stay fluffy, and the insects have to crawl through it a lot. So when you treat the cracks under your kitchen sink, the cockroaches crawl back and forth through that dry, fluffy powder, and it actually works as diatomaceous earth is supposed to. It works very well in grain bins, where insects are crawling through a dry environment where the diatomaceous earth stays loose and powdery. Outdoors, it mixes with water, it mixes with dust, and it loses its effectiveness. I think if it worked for you, that's a good choice. Another good choice in the organic area would be a chemical called Surround. I'm not sure it's going to be completely effective for you, because it may not protect adequately. But Surround is a clay that just coats the leaves, makes them look like you live alongside a dusty gravel road, and discourages insects from feeding. Now, what Matt's talking about, the striped blister beetle, the margined blister beetle, the black blister beetle, these are all collectively referred to as, quote, old-fashioned potato bug. And they are not the potato beetle. They're not the Colorado potato beetle that we normally think of. These are about 3/4 to 1 inch long. They're dark. They're narrower in the thorax. And they're called blister beetles because if you handle them carelessly, and if the oil from their leg joints gets on sensitive skin, it will cause a blister beetle, or blister, a water blister on your skin. So the blister beetles will actually hurt people if you handle them carelessly. So picking them off by hand would be another option for home gardeners who have just a few blister beetles. But when you do that, wear gloves and handle them very carefully so that you don't end up with blisters where you don't want them.
Yeah. That sounds terrible. Are you speaking from personal experience here?
Actually, no.
Okay.
You've never known
to wear gloves.
When I learned about blister beetles, I learned about what they can do to you, and I didn't have to experience that myself. I was able to learn that in a book and figure out how to take care of them. But they also feed on all things in the potato family. They're also defoliating nightshade out there in the garden. So you'll find blister beetles feeding on lots of different things, but potatoes and nightshade are where we see them the most.
Now, we only have a minute left, but we'll take a quick call from Rick in Cedar Rapids, and you can join our conversation in the next segment as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. Hi, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. My observation on Japanese beetles because of our cherry tree and wild rose plants has been that the aviary, the birds such as robins and sparrows, have been becoming more adept to the defense mechanism of the Japanese beetle. When a bird lands on a branch where they notice the webbing,
uh-huh.
they look for the beetle, but the beetle drops.
Sure, play possum.
They just go right down. Now, I've seen the evidence of birds' adaptability in the fact that the robin or the sparrow will drop with the beetle and pick it off before it hits the ground. The other thing they do is they land, instead of looking down, they look up.
Wow.
And now they're picking them off from underneath the leaf where usually you find the Japanese beetle.
I guess we need more birds. It's kind of hard to believe, Japanese beetles are a large insect. They're kind of a lot of shell. They're probably not terribly nutritious, and I would think they would be hard to chew, swallow, and digest. But no, there's a predator out there for everything. It's just when we get these outbreaks, the predators can't keep up. Witness the mayfly abundance we've had this year, the buffalo gnats that are out there in eastern Iowa now, and Japanese beetles in years past. They overwhelm their predators, and they succeed in spite of them. But good to know about the birds.
Thanks for your call, Rick. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. We're talking about the ecosystem of birds, bugs, plants. With me today is Donald Lewis of Iowa State University Extension Entomology and Richard Duran of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. And you can join our conversation as well with your stories and comments and questions. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Charity Nebbe. And with me this hour are Donald Lewis and Richard Duran of Iowa State University Extension. It's Horticulture Day, and we're taking all of your plant and garden questions, even insect questions today. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, and you can post to our Facebook page. Up next is a question from Brian in Panora. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Emily. Say, I live in Panora, which is about 50 miles west of Des Moines. Mm-hmm. And we had just a tremendous amount of cicadas, I think they were, early summer. But now we're seeing, and it doesn't matter what kind of tree it's on, whether it's a leafing tree, but it doesn't matter if it's an oak or a maple or a cottonwood, many, many ends, tips of the branches broken off and the leaves are dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been told that those are from cicadas, but nobody really seems to know for sure, and so that's what my question is.
Oh, well, sure. You're seeing the consequence of the 17-year cicada, the periodical cicadas that were here pretty much for the month of June, and then with the heavy rains of early July, they were kind of gone by the middle of July. But on their way out, they did what has to be done in the adult stage and can only be done in the adult stage. That is, the males and females mate, and then the female lays her eggs. And the female periodical cicada inserts her eggs into twigs that are approximately a quarter inch in diameter, sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more. And you're right. It can be oak trees. It can be maple trees. It can be aronia berries. It can be other plants as well, that she lays her eggs in the twigs and in the stems. And those eggs wait about 6 weeks before they hatch. Now, that egg-laying operation does kill the twig from the point of egg laying on out. Often they will just turn brown. Sometimes they turn brown and brittle and they break off, they snap off. And that collectively is referred to as flagging. The trees are flagged because of the egg laying operation of the periodical cicada. This has happened in the Iowa woodlands and the woodlands from Kansas City to the Atlantic Ocean every 17th year for about the last 10,000 years. So the trees are pretty well adapted to this. Those forest trees, our larger ornamental trees, are not going to be hurt by it. If it was your aronia berries or if it was a plant that you were trying to produce from, like orchard trees, yeah, you're going to lose some production. But otherwise, this isn't anything of concern for woodlands and for mature landscapes. It is a problem for nurseries and orchards. And now it's too late. The damage is done. You just have to prune it out and go on and get what you can. But flagging by the periodical cicada is the consequence of all that egg laying that was done back in early July.
Thanks, Brian.
Interesting. Well, follow up to that then. So they lay their eggs in these branches.
Right.
Then what happens to them? I mean, the eggs develop, and is that when they drop into the ground, to burrow into the ground, or what happens?
Exactly that. After about 6 weeks as an egg, they hatch as a tiny little nymph that's only about a quarter inch length. And the first survival test of the new cicadas is to drop to the ground, burrow into the ground, and start feeding on sap from a tree root. and whatever root they attach to, they hope to feed on for the next 17 years so that they can transform to an adult and reappear above ground in the adult stage in the year 2031. So in the summer, in late summer of 2031, your trees around your property will look like this again.
Well, I probably won't be around to see that, but it's interesting how that works. So I appreciate your answer on that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Brian. We have another cicada question from over in Clive. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question regarding to music. It occurred to me that they must be singing at a musical note. I had asked somebody, and their 10-year-old with perfect pitch told me it wasn't the E just above middle C, but it was the octave above that. And I wonder, has anybody taken a look at the various broods and see if they all sing the same note?
They don't sing the same rhythm. And if you go to the internet website, Magi Cicada, M-A-G-I, Cicada, C-I-C-A-D-A, mm-hmm. Magi Cicada, and it's a .org. They have a link at the bottom where you can listen to the song of the three different species of 17-year cicadas. And the chain, it's a different pitch, and it's a different rhythm. It's a different different rhythm. Now, a famous musician who was here at Iowa State University also thought it was the key of E. It's interesting that he was a famous violin player here for Iowa State University for a long number of years, now retired. He thought it was an E also. Now, the thing is, what we hear in the woodland can be a mixture of the three different species. So it's going to be a little hard to put a perfect pitch to it because they may be it may be more than one kind, and of course it could change with the temperature slightly. So there's a lot going on there, and yes, the songs have been well studied. They're documented on several different websites, and you can hear the differences, and people do recognize the species by the songs that they sing.
Thank you. It sounds almost like identifying frogs by how many chirps they give.
Well, sure, and we identify birds by the songs. When you're up early in the morning, you recognize the cardinal, you recognize the song of the robin, and people who can recognize songs of insects are a different breed of cat altogether.
Thank you for cats.
Thanks, yeah. Jonathan.
Bye-bye.
And Jonathan called us at 866-780-9100. Up next is Bonnie in Rock Island. Good morning, Bonnie.
Good morning. I have a question. When I was young, 150 years ago, and would play out, we would see all these wonderful lightning bugs. And now when I sit out on my deck at night looking at the stars, I, in our yard, will only see one, and that's rare. And I wondered if they're becoming extinct.
I don't think extinct, but they certainly are struggling. And I recall the lightning bugs of my youth. It wasn't quite 150 years ago, only half that long. But also I can remember quite recently, within the last decade and a half, being out near bean fields where the field would just light up with tens of thousands of lightning bugs per acre is what it looks like. But I agree with you. The lightning bug population is way down from what it was just a few years ago. And if I have to, if I'm forced to guess, which doesn't take much to make me guess about these things, I would say it's been our lousy, dry summers that have impacted the lightning bugs, and especially the drought of last summer, because the lightning bug spends about 10 and a half to 11 months of every year as a larva living in moist, decaying organic matter, under leaf litter, in the base of tall grass, under the mulch, and so forth. And I think when those areas dry out, the lightning bug larvae are at a disadvantage. Lightning bug larvae also feed on the eggs of slugs and snails. And when it's drought and when we have drier weather, we have fewer slugs and snails, so less for the lightning bugs to eat. So I think it's the dry weather that has reduced them. I don't think it's an extinction problem. I think it's probably a lot of habitat loss. We have a lot of tilled fields where we don't have a lot of organic matter on the surface like we would have with prairies and meadows and pastures. So loss of habitat and lousy weather, I think, has brought us to this condition of you and I both see about one or two lightning bugs a night.
Oh, my. Well, thank you for that information.
Yeah, thanks, Bonnie. One thing I've noticed about lightning bugs, and I don't know why, I just noticed it this year, but they have different patterns of light. And that depends on what kind they are. Is that correct?
Correct. We have about 25 species of lightning bugs in the United States. We don't have that many in Iowa. We have two major groups of lightning bugs here in the state of Iowa. But as you go around the country, you'll see these different patterns. And pattern can mean so many different things. It can mean the color of the light, whether it's more yellow or more toward cream color. It's also how high they are off the ground. Our common lightning bug is usually about 3 to 6 feet off the ground, and those are the males that are out there trying to attract the attention of a worthy female. And that height is part of the pattern. And then in addition, what do they do when the light is on? And one of our common species flies along in darkness, and then the male turns on his light, and he dips down, and he makes the letter J in the air, and then he turns his light off. And so there's this light on, dip down, fly up, turn the light off. And that's the pattern. Other lightning bugs will be in, other species will be in trees, other species will be higher off the ground, others will stay on the ground. So there's lots of variation in the pattern as you described it.
Lightning bug performance art, you could call it.
My best lightning bug story was a 4th of July when I was invited out to a farm and they said, oh, we're going to watch the fire, we're going to watch the fireworks, but we'll see them over the fields from sort of far away. Well, the lightning bug's display above the soybean field was much more impressive than the fireworks in town on the night of 4th of July. So, and that was only about 15 years ago. So we've had these huge populations not that long ago. I'm just counting on them coming back.
Mm-hmm. Up next, we have a question from George in Mason City. Hi, George.
Hi. Thanks, Emily.
What's your question today?
Well, question is... what would you use to neutralize the acid coming from the black walnut trees? Is there anything to neutralize the ground so it's usable for flowers or grass or any types of plants?
Well, first of all, it's not an acid. It's juglone. And the juglone, basically, to certain plants, it inhibits their growth. That's what it does. But it's not an acid thing.
All right.
So is the tree still there, or have you cut it down?
Oh, I have tons of trees. I grew a bunch of them over in the 80s, but around the farmyard, there's no place to garden.
Okay. Well, that's as far as the garden is concerned, basically you need a site that receives at least 6 hours of direct sun. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be far enough away from any tree, including a walnut, because you need that direct sun. The walnut tree does not affect all plants. It does not. Certain plants are affected. Certain ones are not. Now, as far as the vegetable garden, I would locate it as far away from the walnut tree as possible. And as far as plants, the most sensitive plants in the garden, as far as vegetable garden, tend to be tomatoes. So I would make sure if I had a garden... If I had a walnut tree somewhat nearby, I would place the tomato plants as far away from the walnut tree as I could.
But there's no way to get it out of the ground, but eventually
no.
it'll dissipate if you get rid of the tree.
Right, it will. So just try to find a site where you get plenty of sun and as far away from the walnut tree as you can as far as a garden.
Okay, thank you. Is there... something's going on with the hackberry trees that we have on our acreage. I'm wondering what something's chewing on all the leaves, and I was just wondering, just curiosity, what I don't plan to do anything about it. They're out of reach. But,
I don't think there's anything seriously wrong with them. The walnut tree is a pretty tough tree, but it's not the most prettiest tree.
Hackberry.
Yeah. And so oftentimes you'll see leaves where they have the nipple galls. And they have holes in the foliage. That's just what they kind of look like. Mm-hmm. The foliage oftentimes is not very pretty, but the tree itself typically is fine. So I wouldn't worry about it.
We have one last question. Time for one last question today. Beverly in Hugo, Oklahoma. She says that locusts, grasshoppers, green crickets of all kinds and sizes, katydids, have taken over our yard, eating every plant in sight. They killed all the beautiful large plants on her porch. Last year, there were wheel bugs all over, but so far, she's only seen one this year, and she also saw a praying mantis. There are millions and millions of them hitting us and landing on us, coming in our house. We're at our wits' end. Please let us know if there's any non-poisonous way to deter them.
Oh, these grasshopper outbreaks on the plains are legendary. And when we get to this point in the summer, we really don't have much to do that will stop them at this point. As far as non-toxic insecticides over a wide area, something like pyrethrin would kill the ones you hit, but boy, would that be an expensive option. So the better option is grin and bear it, endure it the best you can. Earlier treatments sometimes are more effective. There's a Nosema, N-O-S-E-M-A. There's a Nosema pathogen that they use on the Great Plains to try to control grasshoppers over wide areas. That would be an investigation, something to investigate for the future. Once we're into these outbreaks, we really don't have much that we can do to change the course of nature other than let it run its course and hope that it's not as bad next year. Thanks for ending on a really downer one, grasshopper plagues. Wow, that's but no, the Oklahoma prairies, plains, and the Great Plains, they get these occasionally, and it just, like she says, it wipes out everything.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we'll be back next week for Horticulture Day, taking all your plant and garden questions, and thank you this week for all your stories and questions and comments. I want to thank my guests, Donald Lewis from Iowa State University Extension Entomology.
It's always a pleasure, Emily. Thank you.
And Richard Duran of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Thanks, Richard.
You're welcome.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Jason Burns. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about the show. You can contact us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Emily Woodbury. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. And we'll be back next week on Talk of Iowa. On Monday, we're going to be talking about energy, energy consumption, and energy production in Iowa. So talking about the future of solar energy and wind energy in the state, and also about how much energy you use when you go to work, the lights on in your work stay on all night often, and all the energy you use within your house. That's next Monday on Talk of Iowa as we finish our environmental series, Ripple Effects.